Greg, welcome to the podcast.
No, thanks for having me, Gerhard. I've been looking forward to this for a wee while now.
You've been an icebreaker. You're now with Bremworth. Did you grow up on a farm? Because it seems so many people did. Did you grow up on a farm? Yeah, and is that part of your upbringing?
No, I didn't grow up on a farm. I grew up in the Bay of Plenty town of Rotorua. The beauty of that place is there's a lot of nature around, the lakes and the rivers. I spent a lot of time fishing. You've got the surf at Mount Maunganui, which is only over the hill, so to speak. And so my background was in nature for my activities, but my business work was not. And it wasn't until I turned 40 that I discovered, really this whole different ethos around natural products and icebreaker, and I was just absolutely captured by, the notion that it makes sense to wear nature in nature.
You were at Michael Hill, and you make this transition to icebreaker. Is there like a massive mind shift that has to happen, or do you realize there's a mind shift once you're there? Because I was a lifestyle photographer and journalist, interiors and portraits and profiles and food. And then I go into farming and immediately I see the value in it, but then I realize I know nothing. And then you kind of have to relearn this industry. Like, was there a mind shift that happened?
Yeah, there was. I turned 40 and I'd been with Michael Hill my whole life. My whole working life had been at Michael Hill, and I'd had an incredible ride, and it was a great brand and it was amazing people. But I was actually looking for something more. And Jeremy Moon from Icebreaker approached me to come and work for them. And he offered me a great role. And I got there, and I part of the induction was to go down onto a station in Queenstown and spend the night. And I went down there, and the first part of that induction was to go into the shearing shed and hear about what goes on. And I was so hooked from that moment on, listening to the growers, listening to the way they spoke about the land, then the generational investment of time and energy and resource, money to make the land, worthwhile, which in turn fed the animal, which in turn created this incredible fiber, which in turn was the birth of Icebreaker and wearing, natural merino next to skin. And I just got caught up in that whole ethos of, natural fibers are truly, outrageously cool and serve such an incredible purpose. And, man can't come close to even mimicking what nature does. Yep. And yet we try, and we often believe we have, but the properties of wool, whether it be merino or strong wool, are just so unique that they can't be copied. And I was just hooked on that whole idea of it, and meeting the people in the communities that are supported by the farmers, and thinking about New Zealand Inc. and the export side of it. It's quintessential Kiwi, isn't it? A sheep. It's just so quintessential Kiwi. And that's me as well. And I thought, oh man, I've found my home. And I'd loved my time at Michael Hill. I loved seeing people on the best days of their lives getting engaged or having birthdays or weddings, anniversaries. But doing this seemed to sort of, from a values perspective, really resonated with me, and it gave a strong purpose to my everyday life. And I've not looked back since.
It's interesting because I went through the same thing when I transitioned to farming. You just suddenly realize kind of the depth of it and the impact, and then you're hooked in it. And then in terms of wool, when I moved to New Zealand 5 years ago, I thought merino is really, really good marketing campaign because I'm into the outdoors. But yes, Now I've bought into it completely. So I'm like, doing this transition from breathable, whatever, outdoor apparel to merino and even strong wool. Because once you've been in the mountains with all the, this type of gear, you you realize like how valuable it is. When you moved away from synthetics in 2020, and you started pushing the you really started marketing the benefits of wool, did you expect a sort of backlash?
No, not at all. I mean, we expected people to be inquisitive, because wool had been, you know, overtaken by synthetic fibers, and all I can really remember about, you know, the introduction of synthetics and carpet was an ad where there was a strange, you know, sort of wild animal running over the top of carpet, which was the way they promoted it for performance. And then the other ad that I remember was, you know, red wine just sort of dripping off this carpet. And I thought, that's weird. But that's what I recall of it. And so, you know, I think consumers probably were captivated by that rhino and that red wine and gone, yeah, well, that kind of makes sense. You know, if you want something that's durable and doesn't stain, then maybe this plastic stuff's quite good. In a way, they went. And so we thought that, you know, people would be, you know, having to be reminded of the fact that, you know, wool's naturally stain resistant, wool's naturally durable and bounces back after wear, at least as good as synthetics. And in fact, you know, most of the cheap synthetics that you see nowadays, you know, wool's, you know, literally 10 times better. And that's why the price difference. But you know, no, we had no idea that we would cause such a fuss, particularly with one of our competitors who actually does have a bigger wool business than us.
Because you know, we thought you're marketing they'd be happy for them also, right? Because you're marketing, someone can go, oh, well, I was going to buy from these other guys. It's
still... Well, we're not the only place in town, right? Like there's bigger and badder competitors than Brimworth. We simply wanted to go about, you know, extolling the virtues of this miracle fiber, making sure that people knew there was an alternative to synthetics. And so, yeah, it was surprising. And it was really my first day at the brand, and we got sued.
So was that based solely on the campaign about 20,000 odd plastic bags, or was there other ads in the campaign that were saying other things?
No, I think it's evolved actually over time, that particular piece. So at the start, it was we were accused of misleading the public. Now, you're not misleading the public if you're telling a true story, and the true story is that, you know, it is the equivalent of 22,000 plastic bags in average Kiwi home if you put down synthetics.
Yeah.
So there's no claim there. In fact, you know, the Commerce Commission, you know, threw that out. So, you know, I was like, what's going on? You know, like, why are we getting this claim against us? And then, you know, that's moved to encompass, in the last few years, that's shifted to encompass our Let's Go Good Together line, because they think that sort of insinuates that wool's better than plastic. For the environment, now that's not what Let's Go Good Together says. That's just saying let's use natural fibers and let's enjoy the benefits of them in your home, and let's support businesses that are focused around natural products, and especially wool in New Zealand. It makes sense.
So how did that case kind of evolve? Because it was the plastics, but then it turned into a carbon footprint thing, didn't it?
Well, I think that's where it's heading, Gerhard. And you know, carbon's an interesting topic, because at the end of the day, there's two start lines, one for sort of petrochemical-based products and one for natural-based products. And then wool, on the other hand, which has become a byproduct of meat, has to take into account all the emissions of methane from the animal. Now, you know, you could go, okay, well, fine, let's do that. But then the calculations for methane should be different from carbon as well, because it's not as longer lasting gas. But, you know, we're getting into quite scientific stuff here. But my point is, you know, why shouldn't we start with world as a byproduct at zero as well? And yeah, and bearing in mind that the methane or the greenhouse gas equivalent count against a sheep on a farm, you know, is a gross emission count number. And if you look at the farm sequesters an enormous amount of carbon, which is not taken into account. Now, an oil refinery does not sequester carbon. It doesn't bring, you know, so, you know, it's only causing it. It's not holding it. So I'm not sure how I'm sure that's what will happen, is that, you know, our competitor will say, well, because the carbon count is lower on a synthetic fiber, then it's better than wool. Now, the public are smarter than that, and they know what I just explained is logical. Yeah. But the courts will have to deal with those statistics, I imagine, unless we can find a counter argument, which obviously we have one. But, you know, if it was to go down to just to that, then, you know, based on those measurements, then, you know, it'll be an interesting outcome. But then, you know, so Godfrey then dropped those claims, though, for damages. And they did that and said, we're dropping them because we don't think Bremworth can afford it. Now that's fine. Okay, so you think, oh, well, that's really thoughtful. And instead, they added a claim for mandatory injunction, which means that every single piece of advertising needs to be, if they win, we have to go back and say that we misled the public, we lost in the High Court, across YouTube, across bus stations, across billboards, across every single advertising media platform that we used. Wow. With the Let's Go Good campaign. So, you know, that in turn is just such a disingenuous behavior, and really, you know, highlights the type of business and the leadership within that business. And obviously the direction from, you know, the biggest, you know, synthetic maker in the world in Mohawk in the USA. So you sort of go, okay, well, we'll deal with that. I mean, it's not going to be heard until 2025. If that's the case, I suppose there won't be a, you know, a verdict until maybe 2026. It's quite a complex case. So we'll then, if it pans out and we were to lose, we'll rewind 5 years and have to say that, by the way, wool's less sustainable than plastic carpet.
Which no one's going to believe. I think not even the super greenies are going to believe that. So... So, I mean, in all probability, you're actually just going to gain out of it.
You know, when we launched the 22,000 plastic bags by weight, was the average right. weight of a synthetic carpet in your house, that, you know, we had, there was a natural alternative to that. Because most of the carpet in the world, you know, like over 90% of the soft flooring in the world is sold as synthetics.
Yeah.
So when we say that, you know, hey, you're it's the equivalent of 22,000 plastic bags of weight on your floor, the point wasn't anything to do with carbon. It was to do with the fact that that's a lot of waste.
Yeah.
Because it is going to landfill, and you know, if you're going to take something to landfill, then a natural product would be better because, you know, wool biodegrades.
Why were synthetic and wool measured against each other?
My understanding, Guha, is that they weren't up until this point. And so no one sort of took that into account. Consumers were smart. They knew that they were going to choose a product that, you know, essentially was, you know, was a byproduct of oil and was made up of plastic and had chemicals added to it to make it soft and stain resistant and color fast. But they chose that because of the performance attributes that we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
And they chose it because it was cheap. So then you go, okay, and then we come and say, well, actually, guess what? Well, just to remind you all, wool's fabulous. It's what you probably grew up on in your home. It's probably what you grew up on in your schools, because that was the dominant fiber that was being used for soft flooring across the world. And you know, just a reminder, that's bloody good. You should try it again. And all the things that you like about the cheap plastic one, you know, you actually get from wool inherently, and so I think the carbon question mark has come up subsequently to support, you know, this, the argument. So to be honest, it's just a confirmation bias of, you know, well, we make 90% of our sales come from synthetics, so we better make sure that we don't lose that. So we're gonna take it down a direction that was never intended, and we'll win. So that's obviously the objective. It's strange because they sell a lot of wool, more than us, as I said. And so you sort of think, you know, what's the point? I mean, we're a tiny business in comparison to Mohawk. I don't know why they're so worried.
What do you think of the government intervention?
What's interesting that's happening in the industry at the moment is that you're seeing more and more government intervention into brands and the expectations of government via legislation on brands to be a certain way. So there's this, as you know, globally, there's this massive sort of shift towards some would say it's kind of this woke sort of place where, you know, everyone's offended, everyone's responsible and in a negative way. It's very negative culture at the moment globally. And you know, New Zealand was experiencing that, and obviously that's why there was a big change in government and certainly a shift away from that far left more to the middle. And you know, when you're interested in, when you listen to commentators about that, it seems that it's so far left on everything that if you even take a step to the right, you're alt-right.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
it's just because you're actually more towards the center, because you know, it's red. Yeah, so it's very, 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 very sort of interesting. And so governments are picking up on that, because that's voters, right? You know, there's a lot of big amount of voters that are thinking that way. Yeah. And so they're bringing into play policies that appease some of that narrative that's so strong. So, you know, and I'm talking specifically in the flooring industry about but not just the flooring industry, just brands in general having to take back their products, which is a really interesting thing for synthetic carpet, for example.
How do you mean take back?
So end of life.
Oh yeah. Okay, yeah.
There has to be a use beyond the first use.
Yeah.
Which is really quite interesting and you know, that's happening in Europe as we speak. You're seeing it with lots of different products and industries. And, you know, New Zealand and Australia will follow suit, as will America. And bit by bit, you're seeing, you know, carbon come to the fore as being this, you know, huge topic globally. And again, our government jumped on that by saying, oh, we're going to be the first to introduce a carbon tax on farmers. And actually, there was a bit of a gold rush on that, because you know, you see it happening in some of the in the United Kingdom, where they're culling, like just killing the animals because they're saying there's too much carbon being emitted, and you're like, this is outrageous. You know, 200,000 you know cows being killed, not for meat, just to kill them so that they don't end up, you know, adding to the methane gases that make up 0.04% of the, you know, the atmosphere. So you sort of, you know, it's quite amazing what's going on.
Yeah.
And there's so much confusion, I think, around that whole carbon picture, as in general. I truly think it's unintentional consequences of an obsession with trying to be world leading when it comes to carbon, without really going to the source and working out exactly what that carbon footprint is, and thinking about it differently, and really advancing the science from where it is or it was, and where that original sort of carbon accounting measurement came in. Because I don't think that any government would intentionally want to do something that's bad. I just think that the way they're looking at carbon is very binary. And from that perspective, you know, I know a big developer a huge developer in New Zealand who said, you know, so we reduced our carbon footprint just by never using wool carpets by 26%. And that's their play to be more or to win more contracts. And of course, that's a winning strategy. And you sort of look at it and you go, how can that be possible? But that's playing the game and the rules that are being presented in front of you. And so I understand it's an easy win. You know, customers don't really seem to mind. It's the predominant fiber that's being used, mainly due to a lack of awareness. And so, you know, that particular developer was very proud to say it, actually, and was basically, it was like a hack. You know, here's a way to reduce your carbon footprint by 25%. Stop using, you know, wool fibers in your homes, despite the benefits and despite the impact on wool farming and the communities that are supported by it. So, you know, who benefits from those decisions is the big oil companies that own, you know, the other companies that sell the petrochemical based products. And, you know, it's interesting, like just to switch gear and get into another industry for a second. My wife bought me a t-shirt the other day. She was very concerned because she'd bought me a t-shirt that wasn't an icebreaker t-shirt. And I haven't worn anything that's not icebreaker for 10 years, right? And she buys me this shirt, and it's a cool shirt, and it's a surf brand, and it's a surf brand that I, you know, used to wear a lot when I was younger, and I love surfing. And she's like, do you like it? It's not merino. And I'm like, yeah, that's fine. It'll be cotton, so at least it's a natural fiber. Cotton's not the best natural fiber because of the water that it takes to do it, but you know, that's fine. And then I saw this little swing tag on it, and it said it was like, it had like Climacool or something like that, and I was like, what's this talking about? And it was this marketing blurb about the fact that, you know, this was a technology. And so I thought, okay, this is interesting. Let's see what the technology is. Well, the technology was 40% nylon as part of a cotton t-shirt. And, wow. You know, what does the nylon bring? Well, the nylon wicks away, wicks away moisture because it's plastic. And so it dries faster. And so I was like, and the funny thing is, it's the same price as 100%, but it's cheaper. So the input's cheaper. So they sell the same shirt. They add 40% nylon, which brings their cost down, and they sell it for the same price as a 100% natural shirt, which would have cost more to make. And they put a marketing sort of campaign against it. And this is what all the synthetic companies do across the globe. They try and, you know, they talk about, you know, all their environmental credentials. They talk about recycling a lot.
Yeah.
And you can't recycle the synthetic product. Most of the products that are made that are synthetic carpet, you cannot recycle them. It's just a fact. Can't recycle them. There's a number of reasons why, which you know, relate to the type of process that needs to be required, the expense, the chemicals that are released when you try and do it. And so, you know, we all know that recycling of plastic is a very small, you know, industry limited to very certain specific products that can be recycled. And, you know, it's questionable, even those products, whether or not it's healthy to do that. You know, a lot of studies taking place at the moment. So, you know, I think, you know, statistically, they're saying that 6% of all plastics recycled, 6% of all plastic made. It's a joke. You know, it's a hoax.
I've lost trust in any marketing. Not any marketing, but you get what I'm saying. You look at it,
yeah, I do.
And I have to question it because I'm in this industry, and I look at a tag and I think they're just selling nonsense to me, and that bothers me that I can't trust anything, and even something that's maybe third party verified, you can't 100% say you trust it because you don't know from what angle it's been verified, because you exclude one or two things and suddenly it means something else. Besides groups like, let's say, Beef and Lamb, which are very industry specific, within industry, as in carpet makers and business industry, is there any drive to kind of come up against the regulations?
Yeah. So this the situation that Bremworth found itself in 2021 with Mohawk, you know, placing these claims against us has forced us to go out and really push, you know, people and government departments and NGOs to actually look at this whole thing from a different, with a different lens. And it's really interesting because, you know, people get locked into a certain way of doing things, and to think outside of that is hard for them because those are the rules, those are the parameters, that's where it starts. And so, you know, we've found ourselves having to become a fierce advocate for the science, to make the science relook at it. And the science has never settled. Let's remember that, right? So science is only right until someone proves it wrong. And that happens throughout all the time. Like, it consistently happens. And, you know, we think this is the right thing, and then someone comes out with a different way of looking at it, and everyone goes, oh gosh, that's actually the right thing. That's disproven this theory or that measurement. And so, you know, that's often happening. And, you know, the whole idea of plastic being a byproduct is actually completely false, because it's a huge industry. It's not a byproduct. Now, wool, on the other hand, if you're thinking about a byproduct, wool is not profitable. Yeah. So farmers lose money shearing this wool off the sheep. They lose money. And so I just can't understand, because the plastic companies do not lose money. The oil companies don't lose money. They make enormous profits. So how is it a byproduct, and how does it start from zero because of that? It's just completely irrational. And again, you know, I think that type of thing needs to be tested. So, you know, we will be testing it as a result of this court case. And you know, I hope that it helps change people's minds, or at least raises people's awareness to this whole process. And you know, it's quite shocking. It's quite shocking, actually, the way that this has been manipulated to benefit the same businesses that everyone's saying ban oil, you know, and yet they're sucked in by the marketing, to your point, and they buy it. And it's just mad. It's maddening. There is fast growing categories of natural products, because consumers are sick and tired of the synthetic man-made approach to life, and blame it, I think, quite you know, rightly so, blame it on the current conditions that we find ourselves in globally. And so, you know, having a natural product that, one, provides you with a fiber that you can use for so many different things, provides you with food, is good for the land and adds biodiversity to the land, it's great for the soil, you know, there's actually no downside. I think there's a chance, as long as, you know, governments don't enforce and impose too much, there's a chance that people will start to move back towards those natural products. You know, you saw in 2017, Amazon goes and buys, or 2016, I think it was, they buy Whole Foods in America for $17 billion. Yeah. And, you know, Amazon doesn't waste money. They're a smart company. They're data driven. So why did they buy that particular brand? Because they saw that it was a fast growing category. That's the only reason.
Yeah.
Do they care about sustainability? Absolutely not. What they care about is making money.
Yes.
And that's a fast growing category. So let's buy it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I was in Whole Foods a couple of months ago in the States, because my brother lives in the States. And I was surprised by the sheer amount of organic and regen. You know, you think it's a small category. It's their whole category. And it's not just one or two options. It's 10 to 20 options of organic food that you've got. And so that was fairly interesting. Where do you see this government intervention into businesses and into kind of imposing these regulations? Where do you see this going? What's happening in the next 5 to 10 years? Because, like you said, they're catering to like almost the extreme left American voter. You know, it almost seems like it's an American voter. I don't know if I'm like, where's this going in your mind? And
I think we're seeing Europe leading the rest of the world with, you know, life cycle analysis on products, consumer brands and imposing, you know, take back schemes, which brands have to demonstrate that they can sell their brand, but then they can also take it back and repurpose that brand or recycle that brand, so it's not waste, or repair the brand so that it can be used again and have a longer life. And inherently that sort of makes sense, right? You sort of go, I think that sounds like a pretty good idea. You know, consumers know that if they buy a product, that it's not going to just end up in a landfill. It's going to actually be reused. And so products that lend itself to that, obviously it's a little bit easier than products that don't. But the whole thing is getting more out of the same thing, so that there's probably, you know, you could argue slightly less consumption of virgin made products and a higher level of consumption of products which have been able to be used multiple times. Now, I think that type of concept makes sense. On the other hand, so in flooring, what that means, and you know, it's very interesting, is if that's the case, then the synthetic companies have to come up with a way to recycle these cheap products. And with that in mind, I just can't see how they can, because the chemicals that are added to these products once released, if trying to be recycled, would be too destructive to the environment. And so you look at that and you go, well, so what are they going to do? I'm not sure. You know, I'm sure that, well, I can probably imagine what it'll be. There's biodegradable plastic available. Okay, so that's one way in which the synthetic companies will do better, and I think they'll say, well, you know, whilst we can't recycle it, we can take it back and it can biodegrade. You know, like wool can, and so that will be probably the next step. Now, the thing is with that type of, and that's a nylon product. Well, that type of nylon, it's incredibly expensive. So then that takes away the real key, you know, USP of synthetics, which is price.
Yeah.
And so they'll be very reluctant to do that. But the governments across, you know, these countries are progressing very quickly with these types of legislation. And you're also seeing you know, penalties for brands with higher carbon footprints. You're seeing brands emerge which have got the carbon footprints on their products, and Allbirds really has done a tremendous job in leading the way with that type of innovative approach. And really, I mean, their sustainability story is based on the low carbon footprint product that they make, and yet you see how much of a hard time they get for that. You know, like they're constantly sort of being scrutinized, and yet they're doing better than any other footwear manufacturer in the world when it comes to carbon, and yet that, you know, they're being scrutinized so closely. And again, that, you know, you wonder where all of that scrutiny is coming from, and the money that funds all that scrutiny is coming from, and it's not hard to join the dots.
No, it's interesting. I was at a dinner and there was someone who was a lawyer in the mining industry, and he made an offhand comment in light of what you just said now. It's like, oh, but we've got a big marketing company just kind of driving the public sentiment. I'm like, what? You know, it was just they've got a lot of money and they put a lot into marketing. And so they're trying to drive public sentiment. Greg, I wanted to just talk about what's happening at Bremworth. I mean, you've had some headwinds lately. Well, the entire primary industry and hit by the cyclone had headwinds.
Yes.
just maybe for someone who's never heard about this, because the podcast doesn't just go out to New Zealand. There was a cyclone, and then what happened at your Napier plant? So, and just what does that plant do? And yeah, just what happened?
Yeah, of course. So Cyclone Gabriel hit Napier on February the 14th. And to give you some background, and the subsequent flooding that occurred as the stop banks failed, closed down our plant. We were very, very fortunate to have evacuated our plant prior to that flooding occurring, and everyone was home safe. But that plant contributed 70% of our yarn that we used to tuft into carpet and sell in New Zealand and across the world. And around 50% of our sales are offshore. It also supplied us with 100% of the dyed fiber that is used in our Whanganui plant to make a very special product that is the best in the world in my mind. And so 70% of your of your yarn, which is roughly 80% of our sales, were lost on that day. Now, you know, subsequent to that, we, you know, looked closely at our insurance policy. We're fully covered for material damage incurred. There's no dispute. We're fully covered for business interruption insurance, with business interruption insurance to cover our losses during an 18-month period. And so you go, okay, well, you know, can you rebuild the plant? Yes, you know, you can. How long will it take and how much will it cost is what's in question for us with the insurance company. It's taking an inordinate amount of time to come to an agreement on what those two things are. And we still aren't there yet. So we don't have plans to reinstate the Napier plant until we get that settled. What we are doing is we're reinstating the Napier plant's dye house. That's being done, you know, as we speak. So that's the first step to reinstatement in Napier. But we have to be certain that the insurance is going to cover, in which they're entitled to, I might add, the rebuild of that plant. In the meantime, let's say that takes 12 months and you know, it takes 12 months to build a house. It's going to take 24 months, let's say. The brand has to, that'll expire our business interruption insurance. The brand has to find another way to produce products.
Yeah.
And so we've gone offshore to other yarn spinners, or we've actually looked internally as well, and we've had support internally from yarn spinners in New Zealand. And we've looked externally to the best yarn spinners in Europe, India, and other locations around the globe. And there's really, to be honest, there's only a handful that would meet our criteria. But those handful we have been doing trials with to use to make our products. Now, the way that Bremworth made its yarns was, you know, very specific in particular, and it's not easy to copy. And I'd say it's like if Tesla lost a plant and they went over to Toyota and said, can you just make us a Tesla? You make cars, so Tesla, you know. But it's actually the equipment's all set up to make Toyota, not Tesla. Yeah. And so, you know, it takes a lot of time to reconfigure your machines to be able to do that. And it's the same with yarn. And so from that perspective, it's very, very difficult to do, which is why we're so motivated to settle the insurance claim and get on with some form of reinstatement. But in the meantime, we have no chance of making any sales or any meaningful amount of sales until we've got yarn. So we have to make the offshore supply work as well at the same time. And that could over time provide some advantages to the business in some ways. But in the meantime, it's absolutely essential that we get it working. But it's with 9 months and we're still, you know, really struggling to get to, the right yarn specifications and quantities. But once we get it right, it should work. And so over the next 6 to 12 months, we'd hope to seal that insurance claim. And you know, who knows where we go from there. In the meantime, we'll do more work on our Whanganui plant and up the capacity there. We'll get some stuff from overseas. And we'll consider whether or not we reinstate once the insurance claim's done. In the meantime, to be an ongoing concern, we have to get the offshore supply right, and that's a big focus for us at the moment.
You've certainly, from the get-go into Bremworth, you've had a very interesting ride. You came in on the Godfrey Hirst time, and then you had a cyclone.
And COVID in the middle. We had to work from
COVID in the middle. Let's not forget a worldwide shutdown. Yeah, I forgot about
We had to close down our manufacturing, and we had to work from home for 9 months. So 9 months of my first 10 months were spent at home at Bremworth, trying to run the business and get to know the team and get to know the industry. So it's been a ride, I can tell you, Gerhard, but it's been thoroughly enjoyable. And the thing is that, you know, when you're in a business that meets and matches with your values and your purpose and what it is that you love, and what it is that you're trying to bring to the world, and, you know, your legacy that you want to leave behind, then it's not a job and it's not hard. And so when these challenges are thrown up to us, you know, we get in behind it and we go for it. And, you know, there's a really nice saying, something like, you know, this too shall pass. You know, the good times are ahead of us. You know, we've certainly been through a lot of adversity, but, you know, we definitely have a path towards strong profitability that's emerged. And, you know, we hope to have more, you know, New Zealand wool carpets across and rugs across New Zealand and the globe in the future. And we've got, you know, bold ambition for that.
Yeah, you certainly are, you know, and people within in Bremworth are good cases for giving talks about resilience. I think a lot of these challenges would have been harder outside of the primary industries. I think people outside of the primary industries don't know what a tight-knit group it is. Mm. And I think there's a big trend at the moment that might not have been prevalent 30 years ago, but the industry supports each other with mental health, and a lot of farmers are talking to each other, like, how are you growing this? And, you know, where you kind of were secluded from your neighbor, they're now working towards the same goal and helping each other. And I think that is something that puts the primary industries in a great spot to move forward with all these challenges.
Yeah, you're right, Gerhard. It is. It's a very tough community. That you know, most of the farms are generational. They've worked on the farms their whole lives in one way or another. Normally with a university sort of degree in between each generation, and they're very smart, resilient, and creative people. And definitely the growers that I've met, and I've met a lot, they're desperate to reduce emissions. They're desperate to have better biodiversity, and they're working towards it. They're not after handouts, but, you know, it would be nice to get some support from the government in a way, like, for example, specifying wool for the Kāinga Ora build, specifying wool for government departments, specifying wool for rural schools. You know, those types of things would be, you know, a real help, because that uses up wool, and you know, that's good, and it's good for people, and it's good for the planet, and it's, you know, it's good overall. So you know, like, I think there is a bright future. It is very tough at the moment. We introduced 10-year contracts for growers of strong wool in New Zealand. We're the first company to do that. We didn't do that to be the first company. We did it because it was the right thing to do, to try and bridge that gap between, you know, the cost of shearing and the cost of actually farming Romneys versus, you know, either shedding sheep like Wilshire or planting a bunch of trees and losing the biodiversity in the communities that are supported by the farming industry, and of which there's, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of people. And so from my perspective, you know, we want to play our part, and you know, this is not a marketing campaign, this is not a, you know, words on a wall. You know, we care deeply about wool. We're inextricably linked to our growers' outcomes. We want them to have better outcomes. We want them to get better prices. We want more people to have wool on their floors and their homes. And we won't stop until we achieve that goal. And there's a big prize. And you know, the prize is, you know, 95% of carpet synthetic across the world. Well, let's change that. Let's get half of it wool, you know, and that'll give better outcomes for everyone.
Yeah, and hopefully one day there's some regulation that takes into account the value that wool and sheep and farms and adds to everything. But we'll see how that goes. Greg, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time, and we'll talk again soon.
Loved it, Gerhard. You take care. Thanks again.